We'll pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you about the sax little thing. I heard the latest show from Brother Jason, and he's gonna put a coat on the thing. I asked if it was dead like Walsh or Gossett, and I'm sending Gary G. Ward. He said we'll give him hope, but I'm just a little tired, and I know that I can take him at his word. And if there's a silver lining in my brother's latest hand, I'd have to think it goes something like this. When it comes to gaming episode and turning out new episodes, playing at the table that we'll miss. The Nerds Variety Podcast. The Nerds RPG Podcast. The Nerds Variety Podcast. The Nerds RPG.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I've got a great show for you today. I have two guests, and we're going to talk about the One Ring, and we're going to kind of discuss, is it a restrictive game? Is it, you know, are there special things you need to think about when you're running this game? Are there certain things about the One Ring that make it more restrictive than, say, BX? I don't know. So we're going to find out. I have very limited experience with the One Ring, so I wanted to bring in two people that have more experience than I. So as my guests, I've got Arlen Walker of Live from Pelham's Wasteland, who ran the One Ring campaign that I played in. So, and I know Arlen is very familiar with the One Ring and a lover of Tolkien. So I wanted to bring him on. How are you doing tonight, Arlen?
Doing pretty good.
Excellent. Thank you for joining me. And I also brought Gabe, who was recently on talking about 2D20. And Gabe is also a lover of Tolkien and is familiar with the One Ring. Gabe, what's your background with the One Ring?
With the One Ring, I own both editions of the One Ring. I've read them. I have never run them. And I think it would be a great idea for me to try to run it sometime. It maybe would change my perspective. I have been a player in two One Ring campaigns. And yeah, the reason why I'm here is because Jason described his experience as being claustrophobic, and I thought that was a perfect description for my experience. I said yes, and you said, Jason, well, can you help explain what I mean by claustrophobic? And I said, I don't know. I'll struggle to. Maybe we can get to the bottom of it here. So that's why I'm here, because I found it to be claustrophobic as well.
Excellent, Arlen. Why are you trying to box us in with this game?
So I think there's a couple of reasons to box you in with the One Ring. I actually agree that I think the rules, I wouldn't call it claustrophobic, but I do think that one of the kind of core ways that the game sort of establishes its tone and its theme is by limitations on what you would kind of expect to see in a lot of other RPGs, that you don't necessarily get a lot of, or are sometimes explicitly barred from, some of the sort of like things that seem like are standard to especially D&D type fantasy. And the rules make some mention of that at times, is the idea of an example being, because so you don't have classes, but you also have these special I'm going to talk mostly about second edition, but in first edition, second edition, you have these boosts that are sort of like feats, but they're specifically based on your cultural background. And so the idea being is that it's not like kind of, I think especially obviously third edition had the longest sets of feat lists to build your particular set of bonuses the way you want. But specifically the idea of the One Ring kind of embracing this idea that, no, if you're a hobbit, you actually cannot learn to do some of the things that the Dunedain are able to learn to do, even if a sort of starting level Dunedain PC isn't able to do that. That this is part of the restrictive nature of coming from a specific culture rather than coming from a sort of general sort of adventuring background that you can sort of flesh yourself out in whatever way you want to do. And I think that is a trade-off, certainly, right? That, you know, some players will push up against that and say, well, there's this cool thing that somebody else can do that I can't. Why can't, you know, why can't my Hobbit do this thing that I think is really cool? Especially when my Hobbit has kind of other things that are not as cool that I don't necessarily want to do. And I think some players will sort of embrace that and say that that's, you know, sort of the nature of this type of game in some ways, that, you know, that no, there aren't really, you know, certainly we don't really see in the source material evidence. We see a little bit of evidence of Hobbit warriors every once in a while, but certainly nothing like the warriors from other cultures that we see. And so it's sort of the idea being that there's not necessarily anything in the books that would say that a Hobbit couldn't ever become a really ferocious warrior. But at the same time, that sort of in keeping with the logic of the Hobbits as what they're kind of shown to be good at, that we wouldn't have, you know, all of these feats that make you really good at being a warrior accessible to Hobbits the way that, you know, the elves of Mirkwood or the dwarves of Erebor or the Dunedain of the North, or, you know, depending on the other supplements, the Rohirrim have a whole bunch of special things that make them really good at dealing with mounts, because that's kind of their thing, right? They're horse riders. And so I think that, I think it is a restriction, and it's sort of one that the group has to decide whether or not they are okay with, or even if they want to enforce. I mean, potentially, I suppose if you wanted to, you could say anybody can take anything from any of the cultural backgrounds and we'll just come up with a in-world justification. But I think that is sort of opposed to the spirit of the game, although not, I mean, play however you like with your group. If you want to do that, that's fine.
Go ahead, Gabe.
Oh, Jason, did you feel like did you feel restricted through your character choices?
Not so much the character choice. I mean, I think Arlen has picked up on something there, but that wasn't. Now, mind you, when I played in Arlen's game, I kind of remember. I think I did play a Hobbit in Arlen's game. I believe so. And it wasn't that bad because you're able to fall back and do the ranged combat thing and do the other things. And when we did and then I recently played in a one shot from Moria, one of the adventures in the Moria PDF. And so it wasn't so much the character restrictions, I think, that felt tough to me. It was more like the gameplay, the idea of with the travel and, or the journey rules and whatnot. Maybe it's not claustrophobic. I think one thing, and maybe we're going to bounce all around here probably, folks. So just be warned of, you know, mission drift and as we go. But with the journey rules, one thing I noticed in there, and this isn't specific only to this game, I think other free league games have this as well, but the idea that it's because it's forcing you to make a number of roles during the journey, then it, you know, and part of that's resource depletion or whatever, but it's kind of, you know, wants you to be somewhat depleted by the time you get to where you're going. And so it's kind of enforcing that and because you have to make a number of rolls, the more rolls you make, the more chance there is of you to fail, right? And your characters aren't super competent from the beginning. You have different things you can do to enhance rolls, but it almost feels, you know, like, well, whether you like it or not, the journey's going to take something out of you. And which I think is fair if we're trying to stay in spirit of the books, but it felt like it's definitely forcing you down this path and it wants to tell a specific kind of story, if that makes sense.
I think that's totally true. I think that describes the structural biases of journeying in the One Ring in both editions. Certainly that the expectation is that any journey, even a fairly short journey potentially, but especially a long journey, will likely take a lot out of the characters. I think there is I don't think the book does a very good job of explaining this, but I think one of the sort of expectations is that With this concept, one of the concepts in the game is sanctuaries, basically safe places that, you know, you can rest. And I don't think the book ever explicitly puts together part of the point of that is to make short journeys between sanctuaries that you've unlocked. And that's why there's a lot of detail about kind of which sanctuaries are safe for you out of the ones that are sort of available in the world, right? That if you just show up on Elrond's door, you might have to convince him that you're allowed to stay in Rivendell. But it's kind of an odd place. I agree that I think you are expected to, you know, certainly not plot out like a big, long, you know, make it from the Shire to Mordor in one journey. That would not really functionally work, right? Your characters wouldn't make it because you would run out of resources far too quickly. I think the best example probably is the way that the characters move in The Hobbit, where the adventuring party basically goes through kind of a one or a couple of sort of sequences of chaos intermixed within travel in between specific kind of safe zones, right? That they travel through Eriador and then get to Rivendell, and then they travel through the Misty Mountains, and then they get to Beorn's house, and then they travel through Mirkwood, and then they get to Lake Town. And that's basically meant to be that, you know, in the same point being that you wouldn't plot out your journey from the Shire all the way to the Lonely Mountain. You would do these kind of small trips that the characters can handle.
And I think that plays into the different things we have in there, because also at least in the game setting, and we see somewhat in the books and especially in the Lord of the Rings, in each of those sanctuaries they hit at that point, they're probably also going to have a council at that point, right?
That kind of mm-hmm. speaks to, I think, the expected sort of game cycle that you have these travels. When you reach a destination that you haven't necessarily kind of unlocked in gamey terms, you're expected to figure out how to convince the owners or the powers that be that you're allowed to stay and rest there, because there aren't really, you know, we don't really have large cities in Middle Earth, at least not anymore, where, you know, a character can just sort of disappear. Even at a place like Lake Town, right, the dwarves sort of show up and do their best to hide out, but they're pretty quickly discovered and have to ingratiate themselves with the master of Lake Town and all of that. And so I think that totally fits into the cycle, that one of the expected uses for the council is meeting with the powers at, you know, what the gates of whatever settlement you're trying to get to, or however it is that you're trying to convince them to let them have them let you stay there and do your thing and recover from a stage of the journey.
And that's where the character creation did feel a little bit restrictive, at least in this last game with Moria, where we had created our characters, and it turned out that Che Webster's character was the only one with really any skills that were useful at council. My dwarf could sing a little bit, but that was it, right? So I sang a song of our deeds, and then pretty much was all on Che to make these roles during the council, because we had built, the other characters were built, you know, Barry had built a ranger, and he didn't really build in anything, and my dwarf was built as a champion, so he didn't have.
Well, yeah, and that's a place where I think player knowledge mm-hmm. helps understanding kind of, you know, which skills are going to be useful in which situations and how to build. You know, I think that the One Ring does a good job of rewarding a character who is kind of multi-talented in interesting ways, kind of like, you know, we see in the books of, you know, Aragorn. The example that comes to mind is as Strider. He's pretty gruff and tough, and he turns out to be a really good fighter, but we don't really see any side of him other than being a talented fighter and a wilderness survivalist. And then he gets to Rivendell and suddenly starts to behave well, like this sort of courtly figure who knows how to deal with all these elves, and he knows all this poetry, and he's, you know, got this whole side of him that we haven't seen. I think the One Ring sort of leans into that, and part of the way they do it is with these different phases, where the idea is if you want to contribute to each phase, you kind of have to have at least one skill that you can use for, you know, you have your one fighting skill, at least one fighting skill probably, and then you also have a skill that you use for traveling for the party, and then you also have a skill or two that you use in council and things like that.
Yeah, I want to throw it back to Gabe, but I will say in defense of the game, to be fair to it, at least with the council, there were like three I think three different skills or something like that. It's been a little while. I have to look at the book, but there are multiple skills you could use at the council. So it's not like you have to have this one skill, period. Like there are different things you can leverage in these situations. Just in our case, my dwarf, I build him as a fighter, so he didn't really have those. But anyway, I'll throw it back to Gabe here.
What you guys are saying, I am approaching this. I don't know quite where to land on it. Because again, I latched on to Jason's term claustrophobic. There's a little bit of claustrophobia creeping in there where like, well, you got to build your character so that you can contribute something to one each of these different sort of phases. Yep. I mean, one of the ways to approach the game, there's almost like, you know how like D&D has their pillars, their four pillars of gaming? Mm-hmm. This one has three pillars, I think it would be. They kind of break them out here. It's, what is it? Adventuring and adventuring phases. There you go. You got combat and you have council and journeys. And I think my difficulty is how they mechanize these things. I'm not going to get all OSR-y and be like, you know, object to mechanizing social mm-hmm. encounters and stuff like that. It's just, I feel like the procedure and the result after that mechanical interaction just covers too much ground for me. It just goes too fast. In my gaming experience, since we're talking about the council right now, and I know Jason has a hard time with this in all games, is we start role-playing, right? We're here in this council and everyone starts role-playing. And I have had these experiences where the darkness is outside. It's at your door. And we have evidence. We have X, Y, and Z. One of your own dudes was out there and almost got killed. And then we make this really good, full of gravitas appeal, you know, to our betters. Clatter, we roll the dice, and it's a dismal failure. And it's a complete, it's a record. Not only is it a record scratch, but there's just like, I've been thinking about cognitive dissonance a lot lately, right? It's just, and what a struggle suddenly for the GM to be like, okay, what went wrong? How am I going to pick up this football and run it back the other way now? I mean, how do we just, you know, just wind this backwards? And I think my best example, so that would be council. I mean, there's like three outcomes when you do a council role, it looks like, and they're all pretty prescriptive. This is what goes down. Maybe it's not even three, it's just two. Council structure. Oh, maybe I'm wrong there. But the journey, I would just add this. This is the illustration I had in one of the servers. I actually just think that what I look at when I look at these tables, when I look at these rules interactions, is not opportunities for building story and narrative. I just see conditions. Particularly in the journey events, like who does it happen to? You roll and shortcut. If the roll succeeds, reduce the length of the journey by 1 day. That one's okay in a way. You're like, okay, so what kind of a shortcut did you guys find? You can throw it back in their favor. But some of these other ones, you know, if the roll fails, everyone in the company gains one shadow. You know, well, why? What I see is like afterwards, of course, this is what I think it's intending. And Arlen, I think this is what maybe you would argue. Well, you just skin it then. What is the Middle Earth experience that is supposed to result in that condition? I just feel like it's getting ahead of itself rather than what is the experience and let's explore that and then discover what comes out at the end of it. It's like, no, this is what you got now. How did you get that? And it feels more like an exercise in, that's all. I mean, they're both exercises in improv, right? And in exploration and in narration. But I feel like it gets too far ahead. The other word I would have is it covers too much ground. It comes to, this is the result for all of you guys. This is the mechanical result. And it almost doesn't matter if you stop to be like, because the other thing that players are always going to do, as soon as you start skinning that, and then this is the illustration, okay, there's shadow. Okay, you wandered through a dead you wandered through some barrows, right? And you just felt the forlornness, the despair of the ancient people. Well, I want to check out a barrow. Yes, you totally should. Cool things can happen there, but whatever we do, well, let's explore it. But whatever we do, you got to remember at the end of this scenario, you all got one shadow, because that's what the table says. And I just feel like it just kind of gets in the way. It does feel constraining.
Yeah. So I think yes, Gabe, I think you hit on what would be my sort of core response, which is be, you know, you take the mechanical elements that are in the rule book and then you say, okay, well, what's a sort of Middle Earth version of this event? What seems like something that is appropriate? And I will say this is kind of an odd place where the publishing history of the game makes some kind of odd limitations, but also opportunities. The first edition, in addition to the core rules, had a whole lot more supplements and a lot of region supplements. And a lot of the region supplements actually have some really good examples of the versions for the first edition travel tables that are they're pretty similar. And I have run adventures just totally out of the book with basically the table at the end for this is the example for the small scenario that has a lot of kind of flavor and fluff. Unfortunately, it's hard to get those books nowadays, so it's kind of an odd place to be. But if you can find those books, I think they do a good job of showing what is sort of something closer to like the expected version of what happens at the table, where you talk through, like, you know, like your example of going through the barrows, or I know in for the very first adventure in the Tales of the Wilderland, it mostly takes place on a trip across Mirkwood. And so they've got a whole set of Mirkwood related travel events just for that travel sequence. And so, you know, it's inspiring when you do like Bilbo and climb up all the way to the top of the trees and can see the sun again for even a little while. But it's dismal when you walk through an area and you realize that you've walked through and there's spider webs everywhere and you're in trouble if you can even get out by yourself and all that sort of stuff. And that kind of is I think it speaks to, as much as anything, the design biases of the game to have leaned so heavily into here's sort of mechanically what you get from these events. As for the example about barrows, I think that is really one of the places where second edition shines, that because, so first edition, those specific phases of play were, I think, a lot more restrictive in terms of especially moving out of or into them at kind of odd intervals, or like taking a break. Like there wasn't really a way to take a break from a travel segment other than to say, okay, well, you know, keep all of the information you've got right now, and we're going to do one scene separately and then go back to it. Second edition, I think, does a much better job of getting, because it is closer to the kind of traditional hex crawling structure where you say like, okay, well, this is where we are in the travel now. I think that in the example with the barrows, that's a great place where you add more and you say, okay, well, so the first thing that happens is sort of the prescriptive event from the travel moment. You say, okay, do you get a shadow? Do you not get a shadow from kind of wandering in without knowing? But now the characters, in the midst of their travel, have a chance to decide, okay, well, do we want to do this kind of other element of adventuring similar to what you would do in BX or a lot of other versions of D&D? And if you are kind of tracking kind of where the characters are and how much of their resources that they use and all that sort of stuff, I don't think there's any reason why you can't do much like you would do in other versions of D&D and just say, okay, well, the sort of travel has encountered a side quest and we're going to do that for a while.
So if I can stop you. So I think you're giving some advice for how to make this game more fun. And so you would take the result on the travel table and you would take that first. So if we did roll shadow, everyone in the company does gain 1 point of shadow. It's spooky and you're getting that And then
if the role fails, so I think that's right. That's the place right. where if you start. Is you have right, the yeah. kind of small challenge. Oh, you say, okay,
and do let's your... not get started there. The role yeah. is going to fail.
Roles fail.
Once the role fails, everyone gets a point of shadow. And then, but then, so that's just what I want to clarify. Your advice yeah. is actually resolve that.
Yes.
Resolve that. And then if this fiction's interesting right now, now move into a different phase. Move yeah. into like an adventure site phase.
Do a combat or do an adventure site whatever or whatever. Comes up. Whatever you comes feel like is it. Yeah, whatever is appropriate for that sequence. I think that sort of speaks to broadly kind of where I think the One Ring really shines. You're talking about the council and how difficult it is when the players kind of do a great role play and then roll badly and then it's a failure. And how do we kind of reconcile that? I think that so much of the way that the mechanical structure of this game is built is much more oriented towards character kind of goals and decisions rather than the I don't know how to put it specifically, but to use an example, when I was running the game, and I've run several different campaigns with this system, and in councils, often what we do is have the characters describe basically what they want to do and then roll the dice and then play out kind of what the dice suggest happened in the scene. Right, that if you want to make an impassioned argument, what you do is you basically roll the dice to see how effective is the impassioned argument and then sort of construct the fiction around the result from the dice rather than making the argument and then seeing based on the dice how effective it was. And I think along those lines, that's kind of a similar thing with the travels. I think a lot of these journey events, the event that happens is something that you can't really do anything about. It's a, you know, there's a danger that you have to deal with right now. Roll the dice to see if you deal with it or not. But after it's dealt with, there's no reason why you can't kind of engage further with it based on what the characters want to do, based on the kind of specific circumstances of the event. And right in the Barrow example, right, the idea that, you know, they don't necessarily get to decide whether or not they just bumble into the place of shadow. But once they know it's there, they can totally decide whether they want to investigate further or to go off and do something else. And that in the same way in the council, that I think councils are a very odd one because of the way, in part because of the way that most RPGs handle this sort of situation, is that for the most part, what I think we're used to is when there is talkie-talkie sequences in games, generally a player says what they want their character to say, and then we roll to see kind of how effective that is. And I think that the game doesn't really express that that's not probably the best way or the most fitting way to run this sort of thing. That, you know, and in the same way, right, you probably wouldn't make a player sing a song if they wanted to use song. I think it's kind of similar to that if you, you know, a player.
Some of us do.
Well, you might. But that you might, you know, you say, OK, well, sort of what's your character's goal? What are they trying to accomplish with this particular kind of use of a skill? What are they trying to do in the fiction? And then we roll to see kind of how well they do and how much effect it has on the people around them. Partly because I think that, for me, has created a lot of the most interesting sequences in Council is when you get those kind of dismal failures or great successes off of what seems like a fairly routine, like, well, I want the character to like me us a little bit more and be a little more willing to let us stay here. And then you roll your great success and suddenly it's, you know, oh, it's somehow you've tapped into something that matters a whole lot to this official personage, or, you know, in the same way you've tapped into something that is one of their, you know, deep dark secrets that they now hate you because you've rolled this thing. And we didn't necessarily know ahead of time that was going to be a major part of the story, but that also, I think, really fits with the fiction of the idea of these powerful figures that often have hidden agendas and also often have reason to be wary of just running your mouth off around them.
Have we determined that this game, so what is unique about this game, Jason, is that it inverts or reverses our traditional expectations for role playing?
So, you know, I've been, while you guys were talking, I've been thinking, and this, to some degree, this goes to the whole premature imagination argument that's been done on this podcast before. And I think it ties into 2D20 a little bit as well. Anything with meta currency, because let's say you're fighting a combat in Conan, right? You really can't describe the final way that scene plays out until all the meta currencies rolled and all meta currencies spent and rolled and all that. So you can say, I'm going to go chop his head off or whatever, but until you finish all the die rolls, you really can't say that, right? So you really need to say, I'm going to try to do this, and then you roll the dice, and then you describe the result. So it's not that.
In fact, you spend your momentum to describe the result, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You can do X, Y, and Z. Yeah.
Right. So it's not that dissimilar from that, the way Arlen's describing how to do the council, really.
I'm glad you brought up Conan. I do need to put in, like, my main, besides the journey, and well, I mean, I get bored during the one ring combat. Straight up. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like a lot of options. You choose your stance. Mm-hmm. You could try the old school thing. GM, give me some descriptions. Is there something I can use for a bonus dice? But it's just tedious, if anything else, right? I did think that the game probably, I'm getting sidetracked, but I'm like, when I first read the game, I'm like, these guys have figured out how to do theater of the mind, but with some tactics. And maybe they have. It's just still not enough for me. I would still need a little bit of a battle map and some more traits, if you will, put down on the table that I can interact with. But when you were talking, Arlen, about the council, and this, I don't know, this is my own little puzzle. I can't get by it. I was thinking about Conan, because for me, I play a lot of Conan 2D20, and I tell everyone, guys, I know that a lot of role-playing games, you're not supposed to be rolling dice. In this game, dice are your friends. You'd roll the dice to see what happens, and you tell the story accordingly. But for some reason, when it comes to a social encounter, they role play. And when they fail that, I can pivot on a dime. I know exactly why they failed. And I think if I'm going to guess, I'm going to guess that it is more mimetic, you know, the heroism is brought down in Conan. So people have petty reasons, prejudices, anything. You can make up anything, but things are at stake in a, you know, heroic tale like The Lord of the Rings, so that you just fall on your face. So roll that dice first and just figure out if you succeeded or not, and then skin it.
I think roll the dice first. And also, I think there's a lot at stake within something like the Lord of the Rings storyline. Obviously, you know, the Reaper, Return of the Shadow, and all the terrible things that could happen. But we also have a lot of evidence within the story of just how disunified the Free Peoples are, especially at the beginning of the War of the Ring. And I think that's a place where the sort of council side of things also becomes interesting, that, you know, in the Fellowship of the Ring, when they're trying to decide how to get to Mordor, and one of the questions is, well, can we go through the Gap of Rohan, or is that too close to Saruman? And also, we don't know what the state of Rohan is like, because Gandalf has been there recently, and he knows that Theoden is not doing great, and has it perhaps gotten a lot worse? And it's sort of, there's a lot of kind of moments where I think despite the idea that, you know, certainly we would all want to be opposed to the shadow in a world like this, and our player characters are presumably all opposed to the shadow, I do think that the One Ring presents plenty of reasons for that kind of petty behavior, or even not necessarily even petty. I mean, sometimes, you know, plenty of times it is petty, but sometimes it's also like, I mean, I think that the example that always comes to mind is the idea of Denethor trying to reject the aid that Gandalf is offering. And his reasoning is basically because Denethor is a very intelligent man. And because he is so intelligent, he kind of can't foresee a victory for Gondor and so thinks it's all over, right?
Remember, he was in consultation with the Palantir as well, though.
And he
I think in almost every case, I think we see these figures have been corrupted to some degree by their interaction with the Shadow. So, I think that is a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let me throw this out there, because I'm curious. Now we're on total tangent. That's okay. Mm-hmm. So the thing that always, that it never really gets, well, I don't know. We're rereading the Lord of the Rings now. We're doing a read-along, and we're just getting into the Return of the King now. So this might be coming up. But one thing that really jumped out at the Fellowship and at the Council at Rivendell is the fact your dwarves, like the dwarves of the Lonely Mountain, are being very cagey and very much, well, you know, we're not sure if we're going to join with Mordor or not. Now, I don't know that they really want to join with Mordor, but, you know, if you're setting that time and place and your adventuring party shows up at the Lonely Mountain, you know, and the dwarves there know that you're being chased, you know, by the agents of the enemy, then they're going to be very likely, you know, not really want you to stay there, because potentially they're working, they have this peace, you know, they're working on this tenuous truce with
there
Mordor
may be
at
even
point.
Some benefit in handing you off to the enemy, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, and I think also, I mean, I think Tolkien at times doesn't go into nearly as much detail about it as some of the kind of extended universe stuff in the actual Lord of the Rings. But remember that the elves and especially the dwarves are basically a people that have nearly been put to the sword over the course of their long existence. And the dwarves of Erebor, having just recently reclaimed their homeland from the most terrible calamity that has existed for about 1,000 years, might have good reason to be cagey about getting involved in anything particularly brutal. That I think there is something, and I think that in some ways that's to talk about like adaptations, right? In most adaptations of The Lord of the Rings, I think partly because we don't have nearly as much time, we don't really get to see the idea of like Elrond. I think at the Council of Elrond is very aware that the elves don't have enough power to do this on their own. And that's basically the reason why other people are involved, that if the elves were still at the kind of height of their second age power, they probably would have just said, oh, we'll deal with it ourselves because we're still, you know, super badasses. And that the kind of sense of, you know, the sort of weighing the survival of, you know, one's people and one's kin and the sort of local concerns against the greater concerns of combat against the shadows, I think a major place where the sort of strife in the council takes place, right, is that, you know, it's the classic, right, the right thing to do versus the sort of convenient thing to do, depending on what you're long-term and short-term goals are. But I agree. I think in Conan, it's really easy to have the powers that be get pissed off on a whim or decide that something has gone wrong, or any of the ways that things have, you know, there aren't nearly as many kind of sort of impulse knee-jerk responses in The Lord of the Rings that we see, that even when there seems to be something of that going on, it's very often kind of hidden in some element of diplomacy between the characters.
Good way of putting it.
So I don't know, were there other examples you had, Gabe, from your play experience or thoughts on things that were kind of unsatisfying with the One Ring?
Those two things, that's how I feel about the claustrophobia. I mean, I just don't feel like I have every choice. I have a very small menu of choices in travel and in council or diplomacy and in combat. And that one certainly doesn't need to get belabored. The only other thing to point out, and I wonder how this has gone for you, Arlen, since you've run it, like, what, 10 times, you said? Like, 10 campaigns, like, over and over.
Not 10 campaigns, but at least, I don't know, because we did four or five with that, four or five sessions, Jason, mm-hmm. with you, and then a couple of others with other groups. And I've run one shots for it a couple times. So definitely if, yeah, I run this and probably split evenly between first and second edition, I would say. So, you know, yeah, run it a fair bit.
Cause I want to like the game. I want maybe, and cause it looks gorgeous. You know, there's that. Yes. It has I love Tolkien, and even this game and Tolkien, of course, just has such a strident community gathered around it. But I just find it, and this, I don't know if they even said it in the first edition, but just the target numbers, the just how difficult it is to succeed at even just basic tasks in a game where most activities are resolved by rolling is a struggle. It's a tough one for me. And I know that you could drop the target number from 20 to 18. I mean, your base, you know, to figure out, yep, your target number. And there are hope. I mean, there's little currencies and mm-hmm. people can help. You can really just kind of circle around and figure out how you're going to tackle but short of that, that's been my other experience as a player, is just not only do I have a very small menus of choices, but even when I pick something, I'm probably not going to get that either. And I don't know how your experience has been as a GM, Arlen, or a lore master, and how you have you run into that? Have you found ways of mitigating that, or is that just how it is?
I think there's some of that, especially with starting characters, that they don't have that many options. I think especially with second edition, the big thing is, so first edition and second edition Hope work fairly differently. In first edition, Hope was basically you could spend it to add the amount of your attribute to your die results to try to hit the target number, but target numbers were inconsistent.
Could you spend it? Yeah, GM. I remember that. They were variable. And could you spend it after the roll?
You spent it after the roll.
Yes.
But it almost, the problem is that half the time it didn't matter.
Because it's still so out of reach.
You just didn't hit a high enough level mm-hmm. to spend the hope to get back up.
Oh, okay.
And hope didn't come back very, very quickly. I think second edition, it's one of the book, it's another element where the book sort of expects a level of familiarity with the system. I think the second edition book does a really good job of presenting the rules that you need once you sort of know the rules already and are going back to them. But that there are a lot of elements of kind of familiarity with play that you just don't really get without having played it a fair bit and seeing. So like one of the big things is that I think you know, starting characters will spend hope on almost every role basically that matters to them, right? If they want to succeed, that's just what it takes. And once they get a couple of levels, or you can start them with more experience, or there's ways to sort of mitigate that. But really early on, characters are very unlikely to succeed without putting down that resource. And that sort of feeds into early on also, you as a lore master, I think it really behooves you to lean into the idea of player characters helping when they can, that there's ways to distribute the load of a lot of different tasks, to have a character, you know, aid another, all that sort of stuff. Try to build up your dice pool basically as much as you can before rolling, and then have a fair bit better odds. Still perfectly possible to fail. But that I think the book presents it as that this is something that you do every once in a while. And the honest truth for starting characters is this is something that you do almost all the time if you want to succeed, right? If you're doing a role that doesn't really matter, it's not as important. But if you're doing something that you care about, you should be putting down hope almost all the time, with the idea that later on, when your character has taken some more shadow damage and doesn't have as much hope to play with, you have better skills to sort of make up for the difference, right? That you don't have to rely on dipping into hope as much, but also presumably you don't have quite as much pool to dip into because you've got some sort of permanent shadow scars that are pushing the baseline up a little bit more each time. And that's really a sort of balance in play. And I think it helps if the lore master is kind of aware that that's the way it's supposed to go and is willing to lean into it, right? It doesn't make any sense for a lore master to be difficult about having PCs help each other out at a task where they could reasonably do so, because they do need a lot of help, especially early on. But there's also, and there's also some other, you know, depending on the various talents that characters take and things like that, there's definitely ways to mitigate that. Like the elven magical success abilities can be a really nice thing to have in the back pocket, not for all the time, but for, you know, when you get into that. I mean, we had a pretty dire moment in the campaign that I was running with Jason, where basically one of the characters had gone down and another character was dying and tried to reach him to grab him, to pull him out of the fray, and didn't succeed. And the elf was able to basically pull out a magical success athletics test to rush into the fray and grab the dwarf and drag him out of combat while kind of making enough noise and things to throw the spiders off the trail of the main party and all that sort of stuff. So, it was one of those things where, you know, it was a desperate situation and everybody looking through to see like, well, what could we possibly do to save this character, that worked, but it was, you know, it cost a fair bit of hope all around to get that to actually kind of go off successfully, to not lose a player character. So I think that's probably the biggest thing, is just those limited resources that you start with, almost, and I think that speaks to, I mean, similar to what Jason said about the idea of almost every journey is going to take something out of the characters, that especially early on, the One Ring just functions in a way that uses up those limited resources all the time as part of the sort of flow of the game. And then hopefully you have a sanctuary and you can rest and recover and get a little better, and that helps.
It's interesting when you look at that compared to something like Against Dark Master and the journey rules in there, because the journey rules in there, you're plotting out the journey, you have events, but they're not nearly as prescriptive in there. Like when I was running that, and we're doing that, like one of the events is you see like a ghost ship coming down the river because they're going mm-hmm. along the river, but it's totally up to the GM how they're going to incorporate that in. Are they just going to see it in the distance? Or are they going to interact with it, have a chance to interact with it? But it's left to you. It's not you automatically gain a shadow point for seeing the ghost ship go down. Right? It's well, you know what I mean?
I think a lot of that is Against the Dark Master has a much more kind of a lot of the stuff that, you know, comes out of a lot of the ways that the rules are presented in that game is very much about like the fiction of what happens, right? So like mm-hmm. all of the crit tables start off right. with the description of the fun thing that happens and then say, oh, and here's the mechanical element. Mm-hmm. And that the One Ring much more focused on the sort of mechanical underpinnings, with the idea that, well, the lore master can fill out whatever they feel like is necessary to fill out the fiction.
Sure.
True.
And yeah, that's I think totally why when people talk about the One Ring as being basically a board game, that I think it has as much to do with presentation, that it is totally presented. I mean, the rules are presented very much like a board game. And in play, you totally can play that way. I don't think you have to play that way, but there probably are, I think, people who have looked at this and said, well, there's no, where's the exciting fictional elements of the Lord of the Rings that I like. And then that's the biggest thing that caused people to bounce off of it.
I've bounced, I mean, because there's people like, including you, right? There's people who dig it. We've played it a couple times in my Sunday night group, which came together around Conan, and man, we are playing a lot of free league games in that group. And one player in particular is really enjoying Free League's other system, but also the One Ring. He ran it, and his experience, just anecdotally, is after running it, he changed his mind about it. He thought it was fantastic. And I remember I think I might have even already said this. He was he was like brainstorming, finding every opportunity he could to give us bonus dice on our test, because otherwise it was just a blood fest, right? Yeah. So, yeah, maybe I need to bring it back to the group. I have to be the one. I have to be like, maybe I can make this game sing for these guys. I don't know.
Well, and I will say, I think it's my favorite Tolkien game, but I also think that, one of the interesting things about the professor's work is that between the sort of big three versions of it, of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion, there's vast differences that mean that you could totally do something that is set in Middle Earth with almost any fantasy rule set with enough tweaking, but certainly that it doesn't have to be. I mean, I think the One Ring is very much, I mean, they talk about the kind of intended setting as Eriador in between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and all that sort of stuff. And first edition, it was the Wilderland, the areas east of the Misty Mountains all the way out to Erebor in that same time period. And I think that this is a game that is definitely leaned into that particular version of Tolkien, which is also not necessarily what everybody wants to play. And right. That's totally fine. You know, plenty of people who would prefer, you know, the more kind of high powered earlier ages of Middle Earth, or even, I mean, the Lord of the Rings, we were talking on Discord, Jason, about this, mm-hmm. that the Lord of the Rings only really like a small section of the book fits that well with the sort of expected play style of the One Ring as a game, that they're only the Fellowship as sort of an adventuring company for basically the length of book two of the total six books. Which is fine if you want to play that, but you might also want to play something that is much closer to like the War of the Ring in the later books, and that this probably wouldn't be what you'd use for it because it's not really structured for that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also part of the difficulty of trying to come up with a Tolkien RPG is sort of that I think this leans very much into the, instead of trying to do everything that you might want to do with this story, the way that, like, I think that Pendragon, for instance, does a really good job of presenting all of these different versions of what knighthood is like according to these different Arthurian authors, that Thomas Malory's version of knighthood is definitely kind of the most prominent, but you also have some of the kind of earlier stuff with Geoffrey Monmouth, and then you have a lot of the kind of later, like, Victorian Revival, and even, you know, T.H. White's version of what Arthurian knighthood is like makes an appearance every once in a while and things like that. Because the King Arthur story is this kind of grand tapestry with all of these different elements worked in, Tolkien, obviously, despite kind of a single authorship, unlike the Arthurian legendary, does have all of these kind of different sort of versions and variations within the total of his legendarium. And I think that this game really leans into a sort of very, very particular view of one kind of narrow element of the legendarium, rather than, I mean, I know, I remember reading somebody was talking about using Burning Wheel to play Second Age Middle Earth and basically tweaking the numbers a little bit so the characters were really powerful, but that there are some mechanical similarities there, but it's also a game that is very different in so many ways. And the idea being that you're, you know, if you're evoking a different period of Middle Earth or a different even kind of style of play within a similar period, that this may not be the game for you. And I think that's, I will agree. I think it's a really beautiful book and might be worth flipping through even just for that. But
yeah, I mean, that was the advantage of MERP, because you could bolt Rollmaster on, and Rollmaster was expansive enough. You could do Second Age, First Age with Rollmaster and have your 250th level characters and all that kind of stuff. But now, Burning Wheel, to give it credit, Burning Wheel, the elves and the dwarves are in the Burning Wheel are very much Tolkien elves and dwarves. They might be the best. They might be better depictions of Tolkien's elves and dwarves than any branded Middle Earth game, honestly.
Yeah.
they are just
well, and there's other great. There's like the Decipher Lord of the Rings that came out around the time of the movies would be an obvious pick for a Lord of the Rings game. That it is much more of a kind of traditional RPG structure, but it also has material for so much of the different kind of Lord of the Rings stuff. And I don't think it's almost impossible now to find like the huge Moria mega dungeon box set. But that it's kind of funny that has something that Free League has returned to basically as a very, very similar product that they're doing now. So,
well, people vote. Yeah. I mean, that's always been a big one. I mean, I guess if for some reason this doesn't click with you and you're not wanting to play 5e, like a lot of people just, if you're a 5e fan and this doesn't click, then obviously we have, what do they call Avengers of Middle Earth now?
The Lord of the Rings role playing game, I think.
I think that would be the obvious go to. But if you're not a fan of 5e, then I guess Against Dark Master is probably your next best thing of currently published products, yeah. Right? Without going to the used market. Now, if you want to play the John Borman script, The Lord of the Rings, then of course we need to look at something like Troika or something like that. But that's another story. I don't know any closing thoughts. I'll throw it to Gabe.
Thanks for this discussion, Arlen. You've given me a lot of insight into some of the intentions of the game that, as you yourself say, are probably not evident. The writers themselves are not helping themselves, but you help them. So thank you.
Awesome. Arlen, closing thoughts?
No, I like this game. It was a great discussion, Gabe. I enjoy talking about The One Ring and lots of other RPGs too. I think, like I said, I don't think there's any reason you should. I think despite all of the things that I think are good about this game, there's no reason that you should necessarily feel bad about this not being your version of Tolkien at the table, basically.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, I don't know how much interest I have in playing in Middle Earth, maybe ever again.
Yeah.
I've been running against the Dark Master, which you might have intuited from Jason's comments. And I'm having fun telling Tolkien-like adventure, stories in other worlds with other Dark Masters where the players are actually the Fellowship, the ones that are going to get things done. That's so much more fun.
Well, and that's very much where I landed in a lot of ways, that I like so much about the One Ring in terms of the sort of mechanical stuff, but I also sort of can't help but feel like the bigger show is going on somewhere else in the world while we're playing around in our version of Middle Earth, which is fine. I mean, I think that there's no necessarily reason that you can't enjoy that. But yes, I agree. I think what has been drawing me more and more is the idea of what about a sort of Tolkien-esque or a William Morris-esque version of the world that doesn't necessarily have the specific details of Middle Earth, but tries to capture the, elements of theme and tone that I like so much.
Oh, yes.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And I hope our listeners enjoyed it. If you did, I think the best place to reach both Gabe and Arlen is probably Discord. They're both on a number of Discord servers. And you'll find, although Gabe now has a blog, so I'll put a link to that in the
show notes. That's a secret blog.
Oh, it's a secret. That's not launched yet. Okay,
never mind. You can link them to it. Yeah, but no one can comment on it. I don't even allow comments. I'm like, if you want to talk about the blog, you have to find me on Discord. Right. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, Arlen. Are your YouTube videos up? Do you want me to link?
It's still up, but I'm not really doing it. Don't leave a comment on my YouTube videos if you want me to get back to you. Reach out on Discord or something. That's definitely the way to work it.
There we go, folks. Okay. And worst case scenario, reach out to me and I'll put you in touch with them. So
yeah.
Okay, everyone. Thank you. I want to thank TJ for the wonderful music. Ray Otis for a coffee cup clip art, although today, of course, we're using a picture of the One Ring.
We didn't even talk about Ray Otis is there and back again.
Yeah, let's talk about that really quickly.
Yeah.
Have you seen that, Gabe, by chance?
No, I don't think so. I thought that There and Back Again was James Spahn. Early version of the Hero's Journey. Yeah.
There's also Yes, so that's one of the things that it is. But it's also a small game by Rayot. I say small in the sense that the rules aren't very long, although obviously you play however much you want with it. Sure. But it's Rayotis's attempt to sort of recapture the 1937 Hobbit in role-playing form without all of the kind of later additions to the Legendarium.
Right. I'm going to look it up.
Yeah, I'm sending you the link right now. Sent you the link.
Right on.
Yeah, it's really great. All of Ray's stuff is really, I mean, I recommend going and downloading everything Rayotis does. They're wonderful things. He normally does clip art, very creative guy. But this is great. The other place I've seen people talk about trying to recreate that original printing of The Hobbit is over on some of the OD&D forums. They talk about the idea that Holmes actually used Holmes. In Holmes D&D, just with levels 1 to 3, you can do The Hobbit pretty effectively, adventuring in that world. Mm-hmm. And if you're just using that in some of the Middle Earth lore books that came out later, you know, like the History of Middle Earth, like Volume 7 has some of the stuff, some legendarium, like went in the Silmarillion that was written around the time of the original Hobbit from the 30s. And so, like, you use that and the original Hobbit as your, you know, but those are the only books you use. And Holmes D&D actually matches that pretty well. Not intentionally, but it you know, just
well, and that sort of also speaks to another side of the question of if you wanted to game in Middle Earth or in Tolkien's Legendarium, he also rewrote so much of it over different times, different periods of his life and different kind of attempts to capture whatever he might have been interested in. I mean, you could.
I'm on volume 10 right now.
Yeah.
And I, after I'm all done, I have to lock these away and never look at them again because my headcanon is now completely scrambled.
Yes.
Completely scrambled.
Well, and you could totally take all sorts of different kind of elements in there. And there's plenty of things in the history of Middle Earth that you might do with the One Ring, but you probably wouldn't. You would, you know, all of the different, I mean, even the basic, like, you know, people talk about, you know, well, how many Balrogs actually are there? because it's definitely, it's
a
definitely
billion at one and, point, right? Yeah, whole armies of them.
There's armies of them at one point, but at other points they seem more like, well, there's only a couple, there's sort of like the ring wraiths, there's only a couple of them around. And other, I mean, even I'll, so there's a video game series from a couple years ago, Warner Brothers did Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War, which are bad Lord of the Rings fan fiction, basically. They're remarkably out of touch with the material of the Legendarium, but very fun mechanically most of the time, except every once in a while when something ridiculous happens. That they've got this whole system for randomly generating orc captains that you go around and kill, and so everyone has a different kind of personality and different bonuses. And anyway, aside from all of that, one of the things that the second one sort of takes liberty with is imagining which of the different figures from Middle Earth history are the Nazgul, right? If the idea Tolkien never really specifies 9 rings for kings of men, and then it's just sort of left as, well, who knows which kings of men those are? And that, you know, I think that speaks to, I don't really agree with the solution that they came up with in the game, because I think it basically just involves who are the most famous characters that we can add to this background lore. But I think conceptually the idea of, you know, even within Tolkien's version of this world, there's so much that is not really explored or not really specified or not necessarily set in stone that you could totally follow all of the written material that you feel like is important and still have things to do. Maybe not as much at the end of the third age where there's a whole lot more written material. But that I think the idea of kind of Tolkien gaming in general doesn't have to just, I guess the ultimate thing is that I think the One Ring is a really good game for what it sets out to do, but it has a remarkably focused and ultimately limited scope relative to all of the things that people might want to do within Tolkien Legendarium. And there's also other ways to do all those things.
Yeah, that was one genius thing with MERP is one of the recommended adventuring time periods in MERP was the Fourth Age after the War of the Ring.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's a clean slate, right? Totally open. You can do whatever you want and you're not restricted.
So until that, Peoples of Middle Earth was published and we read The New Shadow.
Yeah.
Which I think is a great launching point for a campaign. I've mm-hmm. tried it before. Yeah. Didn't go very far. Yeah.
Yeah. You could do something interesting with The New Shadow or the Silver I can't remember the name of. There's an author who wanted to write a sequel about the retaking of Moria in the 80s and basically wrote the books and then was told by the Tolkien estate that, no, you're not allowed to just add on to.
I think I might have those books. My wife read them and said they were rubbish. But I think
but conceptually the idea to something that we know from the earlier versions and saying, okay, well, what could we do with, you know, Moria retaken by the dwarves 100 years after the end of the War of the Ring, right? You could do something fun there.
Right, because if you remember, you know, having just gone through those sections not too long ago, you know, one interesting thing, you know, Gandalf talks about, you know, when he was fighting the Balrog, is, you know, after they fell, then they're going through the tunnels of the ancient things that have been there for, you know, there are older things than orcs and Balrogs underneath Moria, right? And these tunnels. And what are those? You know, I mean, you think Worms of the Earth from Howard or something, right? But you don't know what's it's got to be worse than that if it's older than the Balrog, right? So you don't know what's under there, but you know, obviously that would be interesting to explore.
Well, or I think I can't imagine how you would do it that it wouldn't feel like a cheap joke, but the image of one boat that has elves and men on it sailing west and it starts to diverge just a little bit as the flat plane of mm-hmm. Elvendom interacts with the spherical shape of Middle Earth for humans sounds like such a fascinating image of, you know, sort of like 3D glasses that aren't properly calibrated where it just starts to diverge a little bit and then comes back.
Definitely. I think that's maybe a good place to end this, but thank you for this, folks. Get out and, you know, even if you're worried about canon, there are tons of ways to play Middle Earth or Middle Earth like stories, as we've discussed here at the end. So you can get your Tolkien on one way or another. So thank you again very much, and everybody.
It's a pleasure.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Carlin, take care. Okay, folks, be excellent to each other.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if the fiddle's even dead. Bring on the gold, bring on the gold. Butcher is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away. Don't look away. Don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.